Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Copper Bullets. The four-part series from Amazing Sports Stories is available now.
Zambia was considered as an underdog.
Are we going to do the impossible here?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 2nd of July, these are our main stories. The US Supreme Court finds Donald Trump may have presidential immunity over his alleged role in the January the 6th Capitol riots.
We need to say a big no to the Supreme Court for supporting this guy.
Hurricane Beryl has made landfall on the Caribbean island of Carriacou with winds of over 200 kilometres an hour. France's centrist and left-wing parties battle to keep Marine Le Pen's National Rally Party from power. Also in this podcast...
All the Eritrean and African, we must be proud. It's our moment, it's our time.
Cyclist Biniam Girmay makes history as the first black African to win a stage in the Tour de France. We begin in the United States with one of the most closely watched Supreme Court cases. On Monday, justices ruled for the first time that former presidents can have some degree of immunity from criminal prosecution. It was a major victory for Donald Trump, who faces prosecution for conspiring to overturn the result of the 2020 election and for his alleged role in the 6th of January storming of the US Capitol. The Supreme Court decision, 6 conservative judges in favour, 3 liberals against, means he is shielded from criminal prosecution for actions taken in his official capacity as president, but not for private actions. Mr. Trump's critics outside the Supreme Court were furious.
We need to say no, a big no to tyrants, a big no to the radical right, a big no to the Supreme Court for supporting this guy.
And in my opinion, this is a corrupt court that has kicked the can down the road to such a degree that Trump will not get a trial before the election.
Shortly after the ruling, Donald Trump posted on his social media network, "A big win for our Constitution and democracy. Proud to be an American." One of the dissenting justices was Sonia Sotomayor. She wrote that she now feared for the future of American democracy, allowing a president to become a king above the law. For more details on what Mr. Trump is immune from, I spoke to our correspondent Nomia Iqbal in Washington.
It was Chief Justice John Roberts who wrote the opinion for the majority. And in terms of the three categories, he said that there's official acts that are part of the president's core constitutional powers. There are other official acts that are outside their exclusive authority. And then there's the unofficial acts. And so presidents have absolute immunity for the first category, presumptive immunity for the second, and no immunity for the third. And it's a case of now looking at the indictment and working out which part of the indictment goes into which category. I'll give you an example. The Supreme Court said that the conversations that Donald Trump had with his vice president at the time, Mike Pence, who he was pressuring to overturn the election results, were covered by immunity, because that was his role in an official act, talking to his VP. But then there are other examples that the justice gave in which talking to your vice president isn't likely to be immune. And one of the crucial points that I think was in the opinion, when the justice said that a president has immunity with respect to his official acts but also that evidence related to those official acts can't be brought to trial. And so you're left wondering how on earth does the indictment as it stands goes through, because effectively it kills it as it currently stands.
And this scathing statement...
Yes, Justice Sotomayor wrote the dissenting opinion, and she basically said that presidents are now kings, and she railed in particular that the majority declined to rule out immunity for Mr. Trump's role in organising fake slates of electors, also the way he was pressuring states to subvert the legitimate election results, and also the accusation that he exploited the violence of the January 6 riots to sort of influence the certification of the election results. Often justices conclude their dissents very politely. It's a very soft qualifier. They usually say, respectfully, I dissent, but she didn't put that. Instead, she concluded by saying, with fear for our democracy, I dissent.
What impact is this ruling going to have on whether any trial of Donald Trump can ever proceed?
Well, this trial was supposed to happen on March the 4th. I think we can say with a great deal of certainty that it's probably not likely to be heard before November's presidential election, because it's now up to the judge in the trial to work out which parts of the indictment move forward. Donald Trump has the ability to appeal again. We could be here again where the Supreme Court hears it. They don't have to, but that is a possibility, which means that this is likely to be heard after the presidential election. The American electorate won't get to hear the evidence that has been presented against Donald Trump, accusing a former president, potential future president, of trying to overturn American democracy. And here's the crucial point. If he does win back the White House, he will appoint a new Justice Department and kill the case.
And this is going to also infuriate all those people who have said that Donald Trump has stacked the court in his favour and it's paying dividends for him.
Well, if you look at some of the polling, just recent polling suggested that 7 in 10 people have low confidence in the Supreme Court. They don't believe it's impartial anymore. They believe it's ideological. They have pointed out various rulings which they believe have been handed to Donald Trump. 3 of the Supreme Court justices were appointed by him, and this ruling now will just confirm that for a lot of people. There's also a lot of controversy outside the Supreme Court chambers, where 2 of the conservative justices, Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas, are accused of not being impartial, particularly in relation to their wives, who have been accused of being pro-Trump and believing his unsubstantiated claim that the election was stolen. The justices have always denied that they are influenced in that way, but it doesn't combat the fears that people have about the Supreme Court. And even President Biden himself has referred to the Supreme Court as Trump's Supreme Court.
Nomia Iqbal. An extremely dangerous Category 4 storm is moving through the Caribbean, forcing thousands of people to take shelter in their homes, churches and community centres. Hurricane Beryl is the earliest named Category 4 Atlantic storm ever recorded, and with wind speeds of more than 215 kilometres an hour, forecasters have described it as extremely dangerous. It first hit Carriacou in Grenada, but warnings have now been issued in St. Lucia, Tobago and Barbados, where these residents are not taking any chances.
The windows are already secured, boarded up.
I have my water, bottled water and collected water. I have my extra food stuff, my batteries.
Everything you can think about they're getting. They're almost out of searchlights, extension cords, ladders, tape.
Our Latin America correspondent Will Grant has been following developments.
It's very hard when communications are so patchy, as you can imagine they are, as the hurricane makes its way through the Caribbean, to get a full picture. But yes, it does sound like Grenada and these smaller islands off the coast of Grenada have been hit quite hard as it's come in. Obviously, feeling the full force of the hurricane as it makes its way over the island. It is very likely, based on what I've been hearing from St. Vincent and the Grenadines too, that roofs have been ripped off homes. A reporter there has been telling me that that's happened in numerous homes, businesses, churches, official buildings, he said. So we are still waiting for a proper snapshot of how bad things are. But yeah, that is the indication that we're getting.
And I know we get a hurricane season every year, but it's not normally this bad this early, is it?
It's not. This has been pointed out that Hurricane Beryl is really breaking records in that regard. It's the first time that a hurricane has intensified to a Category 4 storm from a tropical depression within just 48 hours, certainly in June, and only there's been six other occasions that it's ever happened at all. So, you know, it is a very fast, intensifying storm that has the potential to cause loss of life, to cause real damage, extensive damage across the Caribbean. I think the governments have been trying to get that word out from the moment that that it was identified as a major threat. But of course, they could have been caught on the back foot, or communities could have been caught on the back foot by the speed in which this has developed.
Will Grant. The Israeli army has told Palestinian residents to evacuate districts in Khan Yunis and Rafah in the south of Gaza. The warning came hours after Israel said 20 projectiles were fired into Israel from the area of Khan Yunis. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher reports from Jerusalem.
People in several neighbourhoods in Khan Yunis first received audio messages telling them to leave, which has since been followed by a message on social media from the IDF's Arab language spokesman, itemising all the districts that need to be evacuated. Witnesses say that many people are already fleeing. The armed wing of a Palestinian militant faction, Islamic Jihad, has said that its fighters fired rockets into Israeli communities near the border with Gaza in what was the biggest such barrage for months. Elsewhere in Gaza, fighting has continued to rage in Meshujair district in Gaza City for a fifth day, while Israeli tanks have continued to push ever deeper into Rafah.
Sebastian Usher. France's centrist and left-wing parties are making a frantic attempt to halt the far right from taking control in the National Assembly. It's after Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella's National Rally Party won about a third of the vote in the first round of parliamentary elections. Now, President Macron's centrist bloc and an alliance of left-wing parties are negotiating sole candidacies for the crucial second round of voting taking place on Sunday. Green Party candidate Charlotte Minvey says it's essential that those opposed to the National Rally work together.
There's a real need for unity. All parties that believe in our democratic values to basically pull out when they might favour the possibility of the far right winning different seats. And the only alliance that's able to try to not have a majority for the far right is our alliance on the left, the Nouveau Front Populaire. We are a few percentages behind the National Rally of Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella. We need to do everything that's possible to ensure that he doesn't become France's next prime minister.
But National Rallies, Mr. Bardella says a right-wing parliamentary majority is still achievable.
I think that with our allies, we will win the election to get an outright majority on Sunday. That is our aim, so I call on the French to stay mobilized. And once we have that majority, I will be forming a government of national union to put in place our program of national recovery.
Just what realistic chance is there, then, of an alliance succeeding in halting the right? A question for our Paris correspondent, Andrew Harding.
It's a scramble and it's a gamble and it's a mess. And today, the opposition parties, they've all been either meeting or plotting or doing the maths to see who will step down so that there is only one candidate opposing the far right in any of these constituency elections. It's not been that easy, and it's not clear either whether these parties and their party leaders really have the control they think they might do over the electorate. I mean, there was a time, I think, when people did do as their party leaders wanted, but these days there's so much frustration with the political elites, with the political process, that's part of why the National Rally is doing so well, that it may well be that voters simply ignore them. But the markets, they are starting to think that the National Rally won't get enough support in the second round to form a clear majority and get into power as the government, which would be a dramatic moment for France. They think that they probably will fall just under that. But I spoke to a pollster earlier today. He was saying, well, a lot of my colleagues think that the National Rally might yet win enough votes. So in Paris, moderate, centrist, usually pro-Macron Paris, no one likes Macron anymore. Everyone in France seems to have had enough of him. But a lot of people saying, oh my God, it feels like a hangover. It's a word I've heard a few times from people here. In the north, in places where Marine Le Pen is very popular, there have been wild celebrations and different sorts of hangovers, I suppose, this morning. People very excited at the prospect that the national rally, after so long really on the fringes of French political life, might be not just coming to the mainstream, which it already really has, but actually coming into a position where it could exercise real power. And of course, people looking 3 years down the line and thinking Marine Le Pen might actually become president now.
Andrew Harding. Such a result for the far right would once have been unthinkable because of the national rally's post-war origins. It was founded as the Front National by Marine Le Pen's father, Jean-Marie, and at the time its ranks included some who fought for the Nazis. Philippe Mallier is Professor of French and European Politics at University College London. He told Sarah Montague what kind of power a national rally prime minister would wield and what they will do with it.
President Macron will stay in power regardless of the outcome of the election. However, the power he will keep as president will very much depend on the outcome of that election. Should National Rally win an absolute majority, his power would be greatly diminished. And his room for maneuver politically, domestically, but especially in international affairs, EU affairs as well, would be reduced. It would be a situation of cohabitation between a president and a government from different political parties.
If National Rally win an absolute majority, how would they use it? What would they do?
I think if you listen to carefully what Bardella and National Rally people have been saying, they've been very keen to demonstrate that they can be trusted with the public finances, and they won't be spending madly. They will be very cautious, very much in line, in fact, with what Macron's been doing the past few years. So expect no great changes when it comes to economics decision. It is more on the issues regarding French nationality, French identity. They would really unsettle, if you like, what makes French people French. And they have a series of measures which are to ban dual citizenship or nationality, or at least curb the rights of people access to certain jobs. They would also suppress the right of sol, which means that if you're born on French soil to foreign parents, you become automatically a French citizen by the age of 18. That would be gone. It's also about banning the wearing of the hijab in public spaces, which is contrary to French laws of secularism, where you know you should be free to practice your religion. So on a number of issues, they could very much antagonize minorities, women, LGBTQI people, and that could probably sort of make the whole political situation much more tense than it is at present.
If National Rally end up with perhaps just short of a majority, but as the largest party, does Jordan Bardella end up becoming prime minister, but with very limited powers?
No, he won't take the job. Let's assume he falls short of it by several seats. Then he already said, it's a poison chalice. What would I do without a majority? So he won't take the job. If he does that, we're left in a political conundrum because it's a hung parliament. The main party is unwilling to govern. So, yes, then Macron would try probably to sort of build a kind of coalition with a bit of centre-left, centrist, centre-right. But would that be enough to reach that majority? And he can't dissolve yet again the House. He needs to wait 1 year for that. So very difficult times, of course, if the far-right win. But a hung parliament would also be very awkward for him.
Professor Philippe Mallier speaking with Sarah Montague. Still to come.
We do not have any trust in our government at the moment. They tell us they will reduce the tax, they will reduce the price of so many things, but every single time the opposite happens.
1 week on from the violent clashes in Nairobi, Kenya, protesters are set to head back to the streets.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
In 1993, Zambia's World Cup dreams were shattered when the plane carrying the men's national football team crashed en route to a World Cup qualifier match in Senegal.
The one source of pride that put Zambia up there among the best.
The streets, the markets, everywhere, the people were mourning.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells Zambia's extraordinary story of triumph born from tragedy.
That was the start of a new era for Zambia.
Let's go and do it for our friends who have gone before us.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now to Pakistan, where the country's first ever conviction for marital rape has gone through the court. Rashid Ali from the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province was found guilty of forcibly taking and marrying his then 16-year-old wife. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etarajan has been following the case.
The family of this woman, now who's 18 years, they say that they had agreed for a formal marriage. After this marriage was accepted, the girl's side, they were demanding a separate house. Now, that was not accepted. And now the family of the girl alleged that Rashid Ali's family, they barged into the house and they took this girl. She was 16 at that time. And they forcefully married and kept her for 4 days. And she was released after a police complaint. If this had happened 3-4 years ago, this would not have seen the court. But what happened was, in 2021, the Pakistani Penal Code witnessed amendments where they also brought in marital rape as an offence. Now, in the town of Shangla, the Gender-Based Violence Court today gave this judgment on two accounts, one for abduction and second for marital rape of minor wife. That was the second judgment. And then they gave 25 years of imprisonment, basically life in prison for Rashid Ali, but his family members were acquitted. And Safir Mia is the lawyer for the family of the woman, and this is what he told me earlier. Now, according to Safir Mia, this was the first time in Pakistan's history that such a significant judgment has been given with regard to marital rape, even though there was another judgment last year in Sindh province that was more about unnatural sex. So this will go a long way in educating awareness among the people.
Pakistan has historically been a very male-dominated society. How's this going to be seen?
We have had a number of cases where the family, they can go and take the girl, they can forcefully marry. Even if they don't want to live with the man, they have to live because of the societal pressure. There is a stigma. Now, this particular case has given hope for lots of women, lots of families, that if you don't want to live with a particular man, now you can go to the court. And then if they were subjected to sexual assault, which they now, according to law, is a marital rape, then they will get punished. So this sends out a strong message to the Pakistani society.
So what happens next, Anbarasan?
See, according to this lawyer, now both of them are still married. They asked for a dissolution of the marriage. That is pending in the court, so that verdict is expected. And second, Mr. Rashid Ali's family can always go to a higher court challenging this lower court's verdict.
Anbarasan Etarajan. In recent weeks, we at the Global News Podcast have been closely following the volatile situation in Kenya, which has seen mass protests as a response to President William Ruto's controversial finance bill. Demonstrations last Tuesday quickly turned violent, with police using tear gas and live rounds on protesters. Human rights groups say at least 23 people were killed. Although Mr. Ruto has now withdrawn his bill, the problem of unemployment and cost of living is not over for many Kenyans, with more protests expected to start on Tuesday. Mr. Ruto has pledged to keep the military off the streets, provided protests remain peaceful.
I must protect everybody. I must protect the protesters, and I must be concerned about their lives. I must also protect innocent people who become victims of criminals who take advantage of a peaceful, democratic process.
It's largely younger generations driving these protests in Kenya, where the unemployment rate for 18 to 34-year-olds is nearly 40%. That includes many who have come through university but still can't find a job. 25-year-old Ivy is one of them. She told my colleague Andrew Peach what led her to join the demonstrations.
I'm 25 right now. I finished school about 4 years ago, but I still have to live with my parents because even if I move out, I would not be able to cater to my own bills. I would not be able to pay my rent, to get food. So I don't really have a choice but to live at home, which I'm fortunate enough to have parents who can support me. But there's so many people who do not have that. So they're forced to look for other ways to make money to sustain their livelihoods.
You joined the protests last week. Tell me why you're involved in the protests,
yes,
because there were very specific things in your family.
Yes, because I appreciate that the government has decided to drop the bill, but it's taken too much for us to get here. So many lives have been lost, but when people try to talk to, they don't want to talk about it or they don't really care. All they care about is the amount of money that was lost during the protests when really there's more that happened. There was also something in the finance bill where instead of people owning land, the state will take it back and people would need to pay the government some amount of money. My dad is a farmer and the money he gets from that is what has been able to give us the life we have right now. If that happened and there was more money that he needed to pay to the government, I don't really see how that will be helpful to any citizen.
Do you think the finance bill is actually gone? We know the president refused to sign it, but do you think the threat of those measures has gone away?
We do not have any trust in our government at the moment. They know how to tell us things. They tell us they will reduce the tax, they will reduce the price of bread, they will reduce the price of so many things. But every single time, the opposite happens. So right now, the finance bill has been withdrawn, but we still have to be on the lookout because we don't know what to expect. We always expect the worst. And unfortunately, it always comes to pass.
25-year-old Ivy speaking to my colleague Andrew Peach about the economic problems faced by many young Kenyans. New UN environmental measures came into force on Monday, which stop any ships sailing through the Arctic from using or carrying what is known as heavy fuel oil. HFO is the most widely used fuel in marine transportation, but it's also one of the dirtiest and most environmentally damaging. Many campaigners have welcomed the ban, although others say it does not go far enough. Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath reports.
Produced from the waste left over in the refining process, heavy fuel oil poses particular problems in Arctic waters. This sludge-like substance is almost impossible to clean up if a spill occurs. Burning the oil in ships' engines generates huge amounts of planet-warming gas, and it also produces large amounts of sooty particles called black carbon. These attract more heat to the Arctic, and like grit on icy roads, helps speed up the melting of snow and ice. Supporters of the ban argue that many better alternatives to heavy fuel oil now exist, and surprisingly perhaps, they say diesel is their preferred cleaner option. Dr. Sean Pryor is the scientific advisor to the Clean Arctic Alliance campaign group.
What we want to see is all the ships in the Arctic move to diesel or distillate fuels. These are cleaner, they don't produce so much black carbon, they are easier to clean up. But also, if you use a lighter fuel, you can also install diesel particulate filters, as we have on cars and on land-based transport already, that will then reduce the black carbon emissions to virtually zero.
While the new ban has been welcomed, campaigners say there are far too many loopholes and exemptions, meaning around three-quarters of the ships in the Arctic will still be able to use heavy fuel oil for another 5 years.
Matt McGrath. Finally, cycling. And in the third stage of the Tour de France on Monday, Biniam Girmay from Eritrea became the first black African to win a stage in the race's 121-year history. Ella Bicknell reports.
Winning a Tour de France stage is often an emotional victory, but this one was also historic.
You make history!
For Africa and for Intermarché. You know it, Bini.
That's the sound of Binyam Gimé's teammates congratulating him on winning the third stage of this year's Tour de France in the Italian city of Turin. In a reduced sprint finish, the Eritrean powered his way to pip Colombian Fernando Gaviria and Belgian Arnaud Delis in what was a chaotic end to the 231-kilometre stage, a photo finish which Gimé timed to perfection.
I just want to say thank you to my family, my wife, all the Eritrean and African. We must be proud. Now we are really part of the big races, and then we success a lot of victories, so now it's our moment, it's our time.
The Tour de France is considered the crowning glory of the cycling calendar. African hopes were high for the 24-year-old to succeed here after his first Grand Tour stage win at the 2022 Giro d'Italia.
I can't believe it. To win in Tour de France, second year in the big bunch sprint, yeah, for me was unbelievable.
Gimé says he's already looking ahead to the Olympics in Paris later this month.
I think it would be nice to represent my country on the Olympic Games, to race with the national. One of the opportunity to race with the national team jersey. And I'm really looking forward for these two big months.
Well, before that, he must endure 18 more grueling stages to see the end of this year's tour. On Tuesday, riders will cross the Italian border to face the Col di Galabier, the first brutal climb of this year's race.
Ella Bicknell. And that's all from us for now from the Global News podcast team. But there will be a new edition later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Masood Ibrahim Kail, and the producer was Ella Bicknell. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
In 1993, Zambia's World Cup dreams were shattered when the plane carrying the men's national football team crashed en route to a World Cup qualifier match in Senegal.
The one source of pride that put Zambia up there among the best.
The streets, the markets, everywhere, the people were mourning.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells Zambia's extraordinary story of triumph born from tragedy.
That was the start of a new era for Zambia.
Let's go and do it for our friends who have gone before us.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.